Professor Sarabji is very kind to invite me in this distinguished and important series. I don't come alone. I come trailing a cold that simply will not go away. So if I become inaudible, you can be thankful for that, but I shall try to be audible. The topic is the First Amendment, and perhaps there's no document, no pronouncement, no law or custom that is clearer on the matter of freedom of speech than what appears in the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Couldn't be clearer, could it? It's a very familiar amendment. It's known throughout the world. But between June 1789 and September 1789, there were so many drafts of what finally became the First Amendment. Madison did not want to put together a Bill of Rights. He thought that the entire project would suggest that the rights are limited. He was also concerned that some might conclude the rights come by way of black letters on white paper, etc. He was loath to do this. Jefferson encouraged him to do it, and several states made it quite clear that the Constitution would not be ratified without a Bill of Rights. So Madison proposed some amendments, not 10, 20. And our First Amendment wasn't his First Amendment. That one was his Third Amendment. What came earlier than that were much more important considerations, like trade, do you see? Madison's focus was primarily on freedom of religion. And what I do want to make clear throughout this talk is the extent to which freedom of speech has always been parasitic on freedom of religion. The history of rights begins with the rights of conscience as those rights express themselves in one's religious confession. There is a rich history behind the First Amendment. One could spend hours on it. It wasn't long ago that we celebrated Magna Carta. I sat back with a kind of Yankee indifference as suggestions were made to the effect that the American Bill of Rights somehow had some debt to Magna Carta. No. There are 63 provisions of Magna Carta, some of them reaching such important considerations as fishing rights in the northern part of the Thames. But the very first provision is important. The English Church shall be free and shall have her rights entire and her liberties inviolate. You see, it begins with the separation of the secular and the clerical. The right of the church to function within its own sphere and not to be troubled, not to be imposed upon by sources external to its own authority. This declaration grew out of attempts by both church and crown to gain controlling power over valued assets, land, taxing authority, rank, and standing. Magna Carta begins with the immunity of religion to secular intrusion, an immunity which in the course of time would extend to individual conscience, and by that same route, ultimately to freedom of expression. Yet 350 years after King John, whom you should know as Bad King John, 350 years after King John had accepted the terms of Magna Carta, Queen Mary and Queen Elizabeth imposed laws that virtually suffocated freedom of the press. In 1559, the Crown issued injunctions concerning religion. How does this sound by today's lights? Quote, "Because there is a great abuse in the printers of books, which for covetousness chiefly regard not what they print, so that they may have gain, whereby ariseth great disorder by publication, unfruitful, vain, and infamous books and papers, the Queen's Majesty straitly charges and commands that no manner of person shall print any manner of book or paper, of what sort, nature, or in what language soever it be, except the same be first licensed by Her Majesty." The aim here could not be clearer. All this was for an imposed uniformity of order in what? In religion. In 1556, this order was ratified by a decree of the infamous Star Chamber, which would add even tighter restrictions over a period of years. The often painful ironies of the history are vividly featured in events that would lead Milton, Locke, and others to record their pleas for liberty. Pope Leo X in 1521 declared Henry VIII to be Fidei Defensor, the defender of the faith, a title he earned when he declared Martin Luther to be a heretic. 13 years later, the defender of the faith would sign the first act of supremacy, which, quote, by which, quote, "the king, our sovereign lord, his heirs and successors, kings of this realm, shall be taken, accepted, and reputed the only supreme head in earth of the Church of England, called Anglican's Ecclesia." So the defender of the faith turns out to be a heretic, and of course is excommunicated. Now Locke composed a letter concerning toleration. As church and state dealt with sectarianism, dealt with alleged popish plots, and the constant threat of civil unrest arising from actions taken by and against religious dissenters. A half century before Locke's letter, Milton's passionate speech, Areopagitica, assayed the true cost of censorship. Says Milton, "Books are not absolutely dead things, but do contain a potency of life in them, to be as active as that soul was whose progeny they are. I know they are as lively and as vigorously productive as those fabulous dragon's teeth, and being sown up and down may chance to spring up armed men. And yet, on the other hand, unless wariness be used, as good as almost kill a man as kill a good book. Who kills a man kills a reasonable creature, God's image. But he who destroys a good book kills reason itself, kills the image of God, as it were, in the eye." Milton was a very good writer, don't you think? As for Locke's letter, it offers three main arguments against the application of coercive measures to create religious orthodoxy. None of these arguments was particularly successful. Locke says that no one would transfer control of his soul to a magistrate. His second argument is that force cannot inculcate beliefs on which salvation depends. And finally, there's no reason or evidence to support the claim that magistrates are reliable judges of religious truth. Locke had critics. Probably the leading one was Jonas Prost, who found these arguments logically defective and counterfactual. In many walks of life, a prudent person does indeed transfer personal authority to others better equipped to address the issue at hand. a fair and competent magistrate who has tested the competing claims of different sects may be in the best position to lead others to truths otherwise not known to them. As for coercion, it may not be generative of authentic belief, but it might and indeed does render persons attentive to those truths on which religious conviction depends. Now, I want to put this tersely and therefore possibly libelously. Locke's Letters on Toleration, of which there were four, is better understood as a kind of evangelism than as a defense of freedom in the civic realm. It's, first of all, the toleration does not extend to atheists. It does not extend to Roman Catholics. When Locke and Shaftesbury get together to help the Carolinas draft a constitution, both of them stand firmly behind what we regard as the Test Act. No one can hold public office in the Carolinas unless he espouses the Anglican faith. Carolinas did not accept that provision, by the way. But I come neither to praise nor bury Locke. I want to point out that the Letters on Toleration do not do the kind of work that Madison is going to try to do with the First Amendment. The objective is different. Now, Locke does get to something more foundational in the second treatise. But this is going to be a bit truncated. You must permit me to be, what, academic. He invokes natural law theory in the second treatise. But you don't have to leave. It's almost harmonious. Do sit down. There's no need to leave. I have rowdier students in my Kant core lectures than that. He invokes natural law theory because it's natural law theory that's going to allow him to universalize the rights in question. All men are dot, dot, dot. And in the second treatise, he actually defines, gives the contours of our very humanity in terms that are essentialist terms. To be a human being is essentially to be X, Y, and Z. The problem with this is that the Locke of the second treatise is having an argument with the Locke of an essay concerning the human understanding, where he expressly rejects the proposition that we can know the real essence of anything. In an essay concerning the human understanding, this Newtonian theory of mind, with corpuscular elementary sensations being parlayed into more complex ideas, you never get to the real essence of anything because the real essence would be some corpuscular entity, in today's language, like a subatomic particle. What you are able to deal with are what Locke refers to as nominal essences. This is a glass insofar as it contains a fluid. But if the wind were blowing and I used it to keep papers down, it could be a paperweight. Do you see, it's by way of convention, by way of culture, by way of historical and civic forces, that something comes to be generally understood to be the thing it is. This is why a number of commentators in the American experience regard Locke as finally offering an argument according to which man is not only made for the state, he's made by the state. The fullest development of this, I promise not to drag you into the weeds, but this is important. The first major jurisdictional dispute appearing before a U.S. Supreme Court was in 1793. It's a landmark case. Chisholm versus Georgia. Chisholm at the time is representing a family. Chisholm is in South Carolina. The family he's representing had made goods available to Georgia in support of the revolutionary cause, expecting to be repaid just in case the revolution succeeded. Georgia did not make payments, and Chisholm brought an action before the Supreme Court. First, it brought an action before a federal court, and Georgia refused to defend itself on the grounds that as a sovereign state, it could not be sued by a citizen in a federal court. And this gets to the Supreme Court. There were five justices at the time. The decision was 4-1 in favor of Chisholm. The landmark, all justices wrote opinions at the time, but the landmark opinion was served up by James Wilson. James Wilson was a native Scot, arguably the best legal mind in the whole founding generation. And Wilson begins with the question, he says, Georgia has claimed immunity on the grounds of being a sovereign state, but sovereignty appears nowhere in the U.S. Constitution. So we have to discover the reference of the term. To what is Georgia referring when it refers to itself as sovereign? And then Wilson goes through this remarkable analysis. Here's the question. Suppose someone in Massachusetts were to bring an action against someone in Georgia. That's imaginable, isn't it? You might imagine someone in Massachusetts bringing an action against three people in Georgia. You might imagine someone in Massachusetts bringing an action against everyone in Georgia. Is Georgia's claim that it has standing independently of there actually being people in Georgia? That is, if they all left, there'd still be something sovereign called Georgia. He says this is nonsensical. And by a very careful analysis, he says we can find the reference to the term sovereign. Sovereignty is in the man. That is, it is in the individual citizen. Mind you, he says, in this country there are no subjects, only citizens. And sovereignty is in each one of them. Now, in case you're wondering why within a year the 11th Amendment was passed, the decision in Chisholm versus Georgia had much to do with it, because this made the notion of states' rights nugatory, really. No state could claim any immunity at all from intrusions by the federal government. The 11th Amendment was designed to repair that problem. But the point I want to make here is that Wilson was speaking for the entire generation of founders in regarding the individual person as the holder of rights by nature, not rights for instrumental purposes, not something granted by the king or parliament. When Madison reflects on what England has, he says, we're not doing what that country is doing. That country has succeeded in reigning in the power of the monarch, but it leaves the legislature free to do whatever it wants. We have a different situation here. The legislature itself is controlled by the people through their representatives. So I do want to underscore the originality of the understanding. Now, you can't get into this without, at least in an academic group, you can't get into this without questions of priority. Now, was America first around the track? You know, that sort of thing. Someone usually jumps up to say, but what about France? Because in 1789, Lafayette presented to the National Assembly this Declaration of the Rights of Man, which expressly cites freedom of speech. I think it's number 13. Of course, number 3 says that the state is the sole sovereign. Lafayette named his firstborn son George Washington. If you go to, by the way, I should share my political biases with you. The greatest American president was the first one, and it has been downhill ever since. But if you go to Washington's house, the anteroom has a large key hanging on the wall. And I was there one day where the guide seemed unaware of what the key was. And somebody said, what's the key? And she said, well, I'm not sure. And I said, I know what the key is. It was the key to the Bastille. And it was sent to Washington by Lafayette with a note. The key of liberty to the father of all liberty. When Lafayette presented the document to the assembly, this was a document richly informed by personal interactions between Lafayette and Jefferson. And of course, Jefferson's position had already been solidified in Virginia when George Mason put together the Constitution for the Colony of Virginia, which reads like the Declaration of Independence. And freedom of speech is everywhere in that, freedom of expression, freedom of conscience. And that's 1776. So I find these questions of priority when it comes to massive historical movements to be rather idle. But let's just say that it's much easier to make out a case that what was pulled off in the US Constitution was much less derivative than one might be inclined to think. Well, we had a lot of trouble. We had a lot of trouble getting the Bill of Rights accepted. There was resistance to the idea. I do want to mention one fellow. Yeah. One member of the House of Representatives during the deliberations, a Mr. Sedgwick, argued that the very statement of something as obvious as freedom of speech would lead to viewing rights as trifling. To him, the effort was all too labored. And then once freedom of speech is guaranteed, freedom of assembly, he says, is logically entailed. Well, Mr. Benson politely replied to Mr. Sedgwick, contending that the wording was really more or less a reminder that the government not overstep its authorized bounds. You see? Sedgwick's rejoinder is a classic. You'll enjoy this. Sedgwick had a way about him. Mr. Sedgwick replied, this is from the notes of the House's deliberations. Mr. Sedgwick replied that if the committee were governed by that general principle, they might have gone into a very lengthy enumeration of rights. They might have declared that a man should have a right to wear a hat if he pleased, that he might get up when he pleased and go to bed when he thought proper. But he would ask the gentleman whether he thought it necessary to enter these trifles into a declaration of rights in a government where none of them were intended to be infringed in the first place. The understanding was actually quite widespread. How foolish to risk one's life and sacred honor on the field of battle. Cutting ties with one's institutions, ancestors, and traditions for the sole purpose of creating a nation now able to tell you what your rights are. The First Amendment and the 9 additional amendments were finally adopted, and so the United States had a Bill of Rights. Regarding the First Amendment, reality would make its presence felt soon, reminding us to this very day that the clarity of a principle soon gives way to ambiguity and frustration when applied to actual cases. The adjudicative history of the First Amendment might be called a controlled riot. It remains unsettled just what counts as speech. Is burning a flag speech? Is making funny movements speech? If in Sicily one does this, is that speech? Granting that speech is expressive, are there some utterances that do not enjoy the protection of the First Amendment? Speech that is, shall we say, more or less unprotected includes, and this is just a short list, obscenity, so-called fighting words, defamation, including libel and slander, child pornography, perjury, blackmail, incitement to unlawful action, threats and expressions constituting what Justice Holmes famously dubbed a clear and present danger. Well, this is fairly wide terrain, and each of these cited categories has a somewhat cluttered record in the courts. Let me give you a slight sampling of several of the leading cases. Consider speech that advocates nothing less than an alternative to the ruling principles of the nation. Following the Russian Revolution, any number of organizations appeared as defenders and advocates of communism in defiance of one or another law prescribing such advocacy. In one important case, that of Whitney versus California, 1919, both Oliver Wendell Holmes and Louis Brandeis concurred with the court's majority in striking down the applicable provisions of California law. In his concurring opinion, Brandeis offered a maxim that proved to be authoritative for decades. He says, quote, "Those who won our independence believe that the final end of the state was to make men free to develop their faculties, and that in its government the deliberative forces should prevail over the arbitrary. They valued liberty both as an end and as a means. If there be time to expose through discussion the falsehood and fallacies, to avert the evil by a process of education, the remedy to be applied is more speech, not enforced silence." More speech. Well, what then of obscenity? The young man in California was found wearing a jacket on which the clearly visible words F dot 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 the draft were printed. Charged with disturbing the peace, Cohn brought his case to a lower federal court and lost his appeal. He then sought relief from the US Supreme Court, whose majority opinion in this case was given by Justice Harlan. Here is the most relevant part of that opinion. I'm referring to Cohn versus California. Quote, "While the particular four-letter word being litigated here is perhaps more distasteful than most others of its genre, it is nevertheless often true that this is famous in U.S. Do you know where I'm going with this? Harlan's, you'll like it. It's often true that, quote, but by the way, italics in the original, one man's vulgarity is another's lyric, Indeed, we think it is largely because governmental officials cannot make principal distinctions in this area that the Constitution leaves matters of taste and style so largely to the individual." Close quote. I tracked down Cullen. Was there life before Google? Cullen was interviewed. He said it was his girlfriend who stenciled this slogan on his jacket. It was the first day he wore the jacket. And he said, actually, at the time, I wasn't opposed to the draft. Well, if indeed one man's vulgarity is another man's lyric, it is less than clear whether any utterance falls beyond the protective reach of the First Amendment, even when inflammatory and racist. So you'd expect there to be some consistency in that domain. Two examples illuminate the interpretive agility of the Supreme Court in the application of what are seemingly the same guiding principles. Let's begin in 1949, Terminiello versus Chicago. Father Terminiello, a Catholic priest, addressed an auditorium of some 800 people and delivered a harsh and depreciatory characterization of racial groups who, on his account, simply did not measure up as Americans. The speech violated Illinois law and seemed to be capable of causing a civil disturbance. Nonetheless, on ultimate appeal, Father Terminiello's arrest was overturned by the Supreme Court by the thin margin 5-4. Justice Douglas, in his concurring opinion, summarized the guiding principle, quote, "A function of free speech under our system is to invite dispute. It may indeed best serve its high purpose when it induces a condition of unrest, creates dissatisfaction with conditions as they are, or even stirs people to anger," close quote. So you say, well, there we are, that's settled. 3 years later, Beauharnais versus Illinois. Here the defendant was charged with violating the same Illinois law that was in place 3 years earlier when the court had heard Terminiello. The law, quote, this is the law in Illinois, quote, "makes it a crime to exhibit in any public place, any publication, which portrays depravity, criminality, unchastity, or lack of virtue of a class of citizens of any race, color, creed, or religion, which exposes the citizens of any race, color, creed, or religion to contempt, derision, or obloquy." Close quote. Beauharnais was arrested for distributing leaflets warning the white citizens of Chicago against allowing Negroes to move into their neighborhoods and matriculate their children in the schools. Beauharnais had not named any specific person as qualifying for such discrimination. His target was an entire racial group. In upholding Beauharnais' conviction, the Supreme Court, through Justice Frankfurter, concluded, and I quote, this is a long quote, but you begin to see, remember, this is 3 years after Beauharnais, three years after Terminiello. "It is not within our competence to confirm or deny claims of social scientists as to the dependence of the individual on the position of his racial or religious group in the community. It would, however, be arrant dogmatism quite outside the scope of our authority in passing on the powers of a state for us to deny that the Illinois legislature may warrantably believe that a man's job and his educational opportunities and the dignity accorded him may depend as much on the reputation of the racial and religious group to which he willy-nilly belongs as on his own merits. This being so, we are precluded from saying that speech, concededly punishable when immediately directed at an individual, cannot be outlawed if directed at groups with whose position and esteem in society the affiliated individual may be inextricably involved. In other words, the court accepts the category of group defamation, the defamation of groups. Now, one of the principles that removes speech protection from utterances that constitute fighting words. The category itself appears for the first time in Chaplinsky versus New Hampshire. That's a 1942 case. Walter Chaplinsky, a Jehovah's Witness, used a public street to pass out pamphlets condemning organized religion as a racket. Ordered by the police to avoid creating a disturbance, Chaplinsky shouted, "You are a goddamn racketeer, a damn fascist," close quote. In a unanimous decision, the Supreme Court upheld Chaplinsky's arrest. Justice Murphy found two classes of speech unprotected by the First Amendment. Speech qualifying as, quote, "the lewd and obscene, the profane, the slanderous, and the insulting," or fighting words, those which by their very utterance inflict injury or tend to incite an immediate breach of the peace. Clear enough? Not hardly. It would be difficult to imagine an example less ambiguous than the neo-Nazis in 1977 choosing the town of Skokie, Illinois to stage a parade featuring Nazi uniforms and speeches against Jews. Half of the Skokie population was Jewish and included Holocaust survivors and their near relations. But the fighting words test in Chaplinsky was now understood as reserved to confrontations of individual persons, not groups. Thus did the neo-Nazis succeed in obtaining a license to march, though the event did not take place. Even those not especially tutored in First Amendment jurisprudence have encountered Oliver Wendell Holmes's famous criterion of speech that comprises, quote, "a clear and present danger," such as shouting fire in a crowded theater. That standard was first advanced by Holmes in Schenck versus United States, 1919. Schenck had distributed leaflets urging young men to resist induction. He was arrested for violating the Espionage Act of 1917. Giving the unanimous opinion of the court, Holmes wrote, "The question in every case is whether the words used are used in such circumstances and are of such a nature as to create a clear and present danger that they will bring about the substantive evils that Congress has a right to prevent." Well, by way of summary, a diverse and generally free people will, when angry or frustrated, develop ever more inventive modes of expression, challenging the pliability of the First Amendment. Hate speech, as of now, is protected unless it falls under categories already declared to be unprotected, such as libel, fighting words, clear and present danger, etc. Before judging just where the courts should draw the line, we might ask how leaders of the founding generation understood the Constitution that they brought into being. Perhaps there's no better authority on this than Madison himself. On March 23rd, 1796, in a debate in the House of Representatives, William Vance Murray of Maryland asked Madison to recount the drafting history of the Constitution. And then later, during a House debate on April 6, Madison again was asked to convey how the Constitution should be understood. He said this, But after all, whatever veneration might be entertained for the body of men who formed our Constitution, the sense of that body could never be regarded as the oracular guide in expounding the Constitution. As the instrument came from them, it was nothing more than a draft of a plan, nothing but a dead letter, until life and validity were breathed into it by the voice of the people through their representatives. The First Amendment now faces two great threats. One is presented by courts that are largely indifferent to the expectations of the ordinary citizen, and the other is presented by courts that are dutifully responsive to just such expectations. First Amendment jurisprudence is not for the faint of heart. Thank you.